Thanks, Ms. Edelstein. All right, this afternoon's case is called Boyer and Singleton versus Health Grades. May I have the name of appearances, please, starting with the petition, Ms. Madsen?
Yes, Paul Madsen, here you are, again.
Thank you. And for Health Grades?
Yes, good afternoon, Your Honors. Chris Kostolansky and my partner Susan Sperber, the law firm of Lewis, Broker, and Roth Gerber, appearing on behalf of the petition.
Mr. Kostolansky, will you be doing the argument?
I will.
All right, very good. Counsel, this case is set for 1 hour. That means each of you have a half an hour, of course. And you'll need to keep track of your own time. Mr. Madsen, if you wish to save a little bit of time for a rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, you can go ahead, please. Thank you.
May it please the court. This is an abuse of process case that involves questions raised by this court's decision in Protect Our Mountain Environment, also known as POLE. That case decided in the context of a citizen action group which sought review of a county boarding zoning decision, held that lawsuits are protected by the First Amendment as long as they are not shams, i.e. devoid of reasonable factual support and lacking a reasonable basis in law. The facts in this case are as follows. Petitioners were former employees of Respondent, an online marketing website. During their employment, with the consent and encouragement of Respondent's executives, petitioners engaged in creating several websites which related to Respondent's business, but which had no clients and no revenue, and therefore did not compete with Respondent. Early in 2010, one of Respondent's executives saw one of petitioners' websites and falsely claimed without any evidence that the websites had both clients and revenue and therefore were competing with Respondent's business. When confronted with Respondent's baseless accusations, petitioners voluntarily resigned their employment. Several days after their resignations, Respondent filed suit, alleging five causes of action. The gravamen of Respondent's suit was the allegation that these websites competed with its business. However, many of the allegations contained in Respondent's pleadings were highly dubious. Respondent claimed that the following websites were unauthorized and competed with its business. A website for petitioner Boyer's amateur jazz band, a dating website, a blank website with no content, and a website specifically reviewed and praised by Respondent's own CEO. Because Respondent had brought these baseless claims, petitioner counterclaimed for abuse of process. The counterclaim stated that respondent's suit, quote, included claims that were devoid of reasonable factual support, and identified specific claims that were shams contained in respondent's pleadings. After petitioners filed their counterclaim, respondent did not move to dismiss under Rule 12b-5, which Holmes states is the proper procedure for an abusive process defendant who wishes to assert a right to petition defense. Nor at any other time prior to the submission of the counterclaim to the jury did respondent argue to the court that the majority of its claims met the Holmes standard. Instead of arguing in this positive motion that the majority of its claims met the Holmes standard, respondent instead requested that the jury decide the issue. At trial, the jury was presented with evidence that respondent had approved the activities that it sued over and claimed were unauthorized, that respondent had disclaimed the formation of any contract between the parties, and that the allegedly competitive websites had no clients or revenues. Crucially, respondent's own executives testified that respondent had suffered no harm whatsoever by petitioner's activities. The jury found against respondent on all claims, including the abuse of process claim. Respondent appealed. Its only argument on appeal was that because its claims had survived this positive motion, it could not be shams. Their appellate reply brief stated, quote, "The only issue presented by this appeal is whether a lawsuit can be a sham when it survives this positive motion," end of quote. Respondent did not appeal the Cone jury instruction that it requested. The appellate court acknowledged that respondent had only appealed one issue, and have not appealed the question of whether the evidence at trial supported its claims or demonstrated that they were not shams. The Court of Appeals wrote, quote, Healthgrades does not specifically address in this appeal how the evidence it presented at trial demonstrates that its claims were not devoid of factual support, end quote. The Court of Appeals rejected respondent's only argument. However, despite recognizing that respondent did not argue on appeal that the evidence at trial demonstrated that its claims were not shams, the Court of Appeals remanded for consideration of this very issue, writing, quote, We reached this result because the briefing on appeal does not fully address the question. Remarkably, the basis of the Court of Appeals' reversal was its finding that the jury should not have been instructed on the phone scam. But in making this ruling, the Court of Appeals ignored the fact that it was respondent who requested, without objection, that the jury be instructed on the poll standard, and that respondent did not appeal that instruction. In making this ruling, the Court of Appeals made several errors. First, it ruled responding on questions that were not appealed. Second, ignoring this court's decisions in Polk and In re Foster, which hold that abuse of a process liability can attach to single sham claims, the court held that a lawsuit containing an unlimited number of sham claims is completely immune from liability as long as it contains merely one claim that is protected under Cohen's standard. Third, the Court of Appeals, apparently unaware that it was respondent who requested that the jury decide the Cohen issue, ruled that the standard had to be decided by the judge and that respondent was entitled to a reversal on this basis.
Let me just interject there, Meg. Setting aside the waiver issue, doesn't it make more sense for the judge to resolve this kind of issue, especially when it in part asks about whether the claims are have any cognizable basis in law? How is a jury supposed to grapple with something like that?
Certainly, if an abusive process claim is based on lacking on a cognizable basis in law, which isn't the issue here, that should be decided by a judge. And I think that's why this court in Cole stated that motions under the petition clause are most properly brought in 12b-5 motion. However, respondent didn't bring that motion. And what the trial court was faced with was a situation where respondent never had argued prior to trial that the majority of its claims met that standard and had requested that the jury decide. In that situation, when the abusive process defendant requests that the jury decide the issue, then it's reasonable for the trial court to submit the issue to the jury. And when the abusive process claim is here is based on the underlying claims lacking a reasonable factual basis, then that's a fact-driven inquiry and reasonably decided by the jury. That, of course, is why it's part of Colorado's model jury instructions. As the Supreme Court of New Mexico noted in the Fleetwood case, when it looked at this issue, oftentimes it's important for trial courts to have the ability to tailor the proceedings to the specific facts of the case. And this is one such case. If the abusive process defendant says we want the jury to decide it, it's reasonable for the trial court to submit the question to the jury.
You have a follow-up.
If I can ask a quick question, you noted that our case suggests that these defense ought to be raised in 12B motion, and that didn't happen here, but didn't they file a 56 motion seeking resolution of that very same standard just on Rule 56?
Right, and I don't mean to argue that there's a huge constitutional significance between a Rule 56 and a Rule 12 motion, but the issue that the trial court was presented with was that respondents' Rule 56 motion only argued that one of its five claims had any reasonable factual basis, and then asserted in three sentences without citation to a single legal authority that its contract claim had a reasonable basis. Prior to submission of the issue to the jury, respondent never argued to the trial court that the majority of its claims met the gold standard. And I think faced with that situation, when a right to petition defense is asserted, but inadequately, and the party asks that the jury decide the issue, that in that instance, it's reasonable for a trial to let the jury decide the issue. But to go back to your initial question, I don't think there's a great constitutional distinction between Rule 56 motions and Rule 12 motions.
Okay, thank you. And the reason I bring that up is more just in terms of the sequence and how it's unfolded. you laid great emphasis on the fact that this jury instruction was one that was presented by respondents. And my question for you is, doesn't that make sense, given that they have lost their motion for summary judgment, that they wouldn't at least want to participate in crafting that jury instruction if it's going to the jury? I mean, if at that juncture, the trial court's already decided this is going to the jury.
Right.
Certainly that's understandable, and they were entitled to make that choice. But once they requested without objection that the jury decide that standard, they have waived the issue on appeal of whether or not a jury should not be instructed on the Pohl standard. They had already preserved their issue on appeal by bringing under Pohl a motion for directed verdict. There wasn't an additional requirement to also preserve it by requesting a jury instruction. And if they had been, if they believed that they were faced with some sort of catch-22 situation where, well, we want the jury to consider this issue, but we're concerned that there's some waiver here. If we do, they could make some record of that fact at the trial. One of the most foundational principles of appellate law is that objections to jury instructions have to be contemporaneously made on the record in order to be preserved. There's no indication that prior to submission to the jury that respondent believed that it was per se improper for the jury to decide the Pohl standard. And that was the basis of the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals said that the jury should never decide the standard, completely either ignoring or oblivious to the fact that that issue wasn't appealed and was waived by respondents. They requested that the jury decide the standard.
And you don't think that the issue of whether it goes to the jury at all is not encompassed by the issue as it was presented by respondents to the Court of Appeals? I mean, as I understood the way it was presented to the Court of Appeals, it was, this shouldn't have gone to the jury because a dispositive motion, if we survive this dispositive motion, we've met, or the other side hasn't proven the Pohl standard.
Right. No, I don't think it is encompassed. There are two very distinct arguments. As respondent made explicitly clear in their appellate brief, the only argument that they were making on appeal was that a claim that survives a dispositive motion cannot, as a matter of law, be a sham. That's an entirely different question than what the Court of Appeals ruled on, that as a matter of constitutional law, a judge rather than the jury must decide the Pohl standard. If we were to hold that every time a party appeals a denial of a dispositive motion, it also encompasses an objection to all jury instructions, there'd be no requirement to have contemporaneous objections to jury instructions, because you would just appeal denial of a dispositive motion and say, and all the objections that I would have otherwise made are contained in this because the case should have never gone to the jury. But that's not the law.
So as a practical matter, what should respondent have done to preserve this issue?
Yes. If they wanted the case not to go to the jury in that hypothetical situation?
And it had been clear at that point that it was going to the jury, whether they liked it or not.
Yeah. I think there are two things that respondent should have done, which they didn't. First is they could have followed the explicit guidance of Pohl and raised this in a 12b-5 motion to dismiss. If that was denied, they could have argued prior to trial in their motion for summary judgment and in their motion for directed verdict that the majority of their claims met the Pohl standard. But there was never an argument prior to submission of this issue to the jury by respondent that the majority of his claims met that Pohl standard. Their only arguments to the trial court was, well, we believe that this one claim is meritorious, and therefore the Pohl standard. So I think had they followed Pohl's instructions and had they asserted and argued that their entire lawsuit was protected under the Pohl standard because all of their claims met that standard, then they would preserve the issue.
Thank you.
Remind me, where I could use a refresher on this. Pohl originally came up when there was an attempt to scare off, threaten, intimidate some property owners who were opposing a land use action, right?
Well, the situation in Pohl was there was a citizen advocacy group,
right,
that didn't want some development to be occurring.
Right.
And the development was green-lighted by a county zoning board. The citizen advocacy group then sought district court review of that zoning decision. The developer brought an abuse of process claim. and then the case went to this court.
Okay, translate that into any updates we ought to know about what the Palm standard is. In fact, can you articulate what you believe to be the rule of law regarding the use of the Palm standard, and what is it?
Okay, so just to be clear, are you asking me for the Palm standards as it's stated in the case? That is devoid of reasonable factual support or lacking cognizable basis in law. One of the questions before this court today is, what should the standard be constitutionally when we have a dispute between purely private parties which address no matters of public concern?
That's the question, a lot better than I asked.
Yeah, okay. Poe's holding that lawsuits are entitled to heightened constitutional protection arose in that context of a public advocacy group. However, since Poe was decided, courts have placed reasonable limits on the right to petition based on the public-private distinction. The United States Supreme Court in McDonald versus Smith decided the year after Poe was decided, held that false statements about a private person contained in a petition were not immune from liability because the right to petition grants no greater privilege to make false statements than the right to speech does. Based on the Supreme Court's ruling in McDonald, the Michigan Supreme Court held in J&J Construction that false statements about private persons in a petition to a municipal board are not entitled to heightened constitutional protection, but are instead analyzed under the First Amendment negligence standard that is used for defamatory false statements about private individuals. Most recently, the United States Supreme Court held in Borough of Berea versus Guarnieri that a public employee's lawsuit against the municipality was not entitled to heightened constitutional protection because it addressed only private employment matters and did not address any matters of public concern. And finally, this court's decision from 2012, General Steele, said that a private employment dispute between two private parties, which raises no issues of public concern, is also not entitled to heightened constitutional protection.
How should we define, if we were to embrace what you're suggesting now, how should we define what constitutes something of public concern?
Yeah.
What should the holding be in a way that would offer guidance to other litigants?
I think McDonald versus Smith says that because both the right to petition and the right to speech emerge from the First Amendment, they're largely equivalent. Not always identical, but somebody who makes false statements in a petition is not entitled to a different standard than somebody who makes false statements in speech outside of the petition. And so I think this court should do as the Michigan Supreme Court did and look to speech standards for an intermediate level of protection for private lawsuits between private parties which don't address matters of public concern. So we already have those tests in the First Amendment defamation context. And I think it's appropriate for this court to look to those as the Michigan Supreme Court did.
Can you help me understand what happens if you win on this argument? What happens to this case? A poem doesn't say we agree with you, and the poem doesn't apply. What happens then?
Yeah.
If your briefing stops at saying poem doesn't apply, but it doesn't tell us what happens to this case.
Right. So the jury has already determined that the poem standard was met. Therefore, the trial court's judgment would be reinstated because a higher standard has already been met.
And what happens to the Court of Appeals opinion?
That's reversed.
In its totality?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Certainly, if you decide on this issue with respect to the idea that the Poem standard no longer applies to purely private lawsuits.
Thank you.
Another issue that the Court of Appeals erred on was its ruling that single claims are protected by concurrently pled. Oh, let me try that again. Another error by the Court of Appeals was its holding that a single claim protected by the poem can immunize all concurrently pled sham claims. In both In re Foster and in Poe, this court held that First Amendment immunity does not apply to sham claims simply because they are coupled with claims protected under the First Amendment. In reaching this conclusion, this court is in agreement with every published opinion of which we are aware including the Supreme Court of New Mexico, the 2nd, 5th, 7th, and 9th Circuits, as well as cases from the District Court of Colorado and the Colorado Court of Appeals. There are important policy reasons why sham claims are not immunized simply because they are coupled with protected claims. If the presence of merely one claim protected under Cohn's extremely low standard for merit immunized a lawsuit that was in every other respect a sham, then parties who wanted to punish their adversaries with abusive, scorched earth, sham litigation tactics would enjoy constitutional immunity for bringing an unlimited number of sham claims so long as they had pleaded only one potentially cognizable claim. This would create a perverse set of incentives for litigants who wish to abuse the legal system by encouraging them to bring as many claims as possible in hopes that one would be found to be protected and proposed, and that the entire lawsuit would therefore be constitutionally immune from liability. The result is that victims of abusive scorched earth sham litigation tactics would be forced to defend against a potentially unlimited number of sham claims without any expedient tort remedy. Sham claims are never protected under the First Amendment, whether they are brought singly or alongside protected claims. Because the Court of Appeals ignored controlling precedent on this issue, including explicit precedent from this court in In re Foster, its holding on this issue was in error.
Does that approach require you, as the defendant raising the abusive process claim, to identify which of the claims are in fact sham claims?
I think a good pleading would do that, and to give proper notice, you would have to say, you know, this claim is...
Claims 1, 2, and 3 are sham claims. 4, 5, and 6 were not contested.
Right. And that's what we did in our abusive process claim. We identified specific sham claims, such as the trade secrets claim, the claim that the websites were competitive, the claim that there was unauthorized competition to shams.
So, I'm sorry, which of the claims did you specifically identify as sham claims here?
Yeah, so the competition claim.
Okay.
And the claim for misappropriation of trade secrets.
Okay.
We also said, depending on what you believe a claim is, that's an ambiguous term, but we also said that the claim that these websites weren't authorized was a sham also.
And so in your view, then, those are the only ones that you would need to show were devoid of factual basis or cognizable legal ground.
Yeah, I don't think the First Amendment, as this court held it in Ray Foster, protects any sham claims, whether they're pled alone, whether they make up 70% of the lawsuit, whether or not there's a sham claim in just the jurisdictional claims. The First Amendment right to petition is a right to petition the government for redress of grievances. And if what you're claiming is a grievance is a sham, then you're not entitled to First Amendment protection, whether or not you artfully plead some potentially cognizable claim. For example, in the unjust enrichment context, it would be virtually impossible, as long as there was some transaction between two parties, to show that an unjust enrichment claim was a sham. And the elements say that that a party is entitled to reimbursement when justice so requires. Well, if there was a transaction between the parties, then it's very hard to, in a sham way, plead that claim. So if we accepted what the Court of Appeals did, as long as there was a transaction between two parties and the party, the plaintiff, brought a claim for unjust enrichment, they would enjoy constitutional immunity for an unlimited number of concurrently sham claims. I don't think the First Amendment means that. I don't think the First Amendment requires private citizens to defend an unlimited number of sham claims without any possibility of redress and tort. There has to be some limit on the scope of constitutional protection. And I think that limit is that if you bring a sham claim, you can be held liable for it.
And what is that? Is that that's a common law tort, is it abusive process?
Yes, a common law tort.
Right. Not been modified in any way by the General Assembly. Still applicable?
Yes.
Yeah.
The final issue that the Court of Appeals erred on is its holding that the judge rather than the jury must always decide the POEM standard. As mentioned earlier, the POEM standard was submitted to the jury at respondent's request. Therefore, in this case, it was error for the Court of Appeals to hold that the issue must be decided by the judge. However, in other contexts, when an abusive process defendant does not request that the jury decide the POEM standard, it would be a mistake for this court to adopt a per se rule that only the judge can decide it. There are times when trial courts must have flexibility in order to craft the proceedings to deal with the particular circumstances of the case that is before them. If we have a per se rule that only the judge can ever decide the POEM issue, then circumstances such as this case, where one party requests that the jury decide it without objection, we create a very strange situation where trial courts aren't allowed to adapt their proceedings to the facts of a particular case.
Mr. Maxson, am I right in thinking that we just have the proposed jury instructions and then instruction 31, which the court ultimately gave, and we don't really have any transcript from an instruction conference or anything else that really sheds light on the extent to which, if it matters, the employer in this instance actively sought the instruction?
I don't believe that's correct. There are written objections to jury instructions.
I've seen that, but I'm just, any transcript that deals with this issue at all,
I did not find it. Yeah, and we went back to Chambers to do that, and I don't know why that's not part of the transcript. You've seen the transcript, and obviously it's not the highest quality transcript you've probably ever read, and I don't know why that's not there.
Okay.
But an important part to remember from those pretrial jury instructions, and this is where the sub sponte issue really gets us into an Alice in Wonderland situation, is we, in the trial court, we objected to the jury deciding the POEM standard. And it was respondent who asked that the jury decide the issue and said, no, this is a jury question. These are the sorts of absurd results you get when courts rule sub sponte on issues that are not before them. We don't have consistent advocacy by either party because the Court of Appeals dug into an issue that wasn't before and made an apparently massive error by failing to notice that the party we were granting a reversal to was requesting the instruction that they thought was improper. So to go back to your original question, I think that's another example of why there are limits on sub sponte review and why sub sponte review is limited to situations where there's very clear error and that it is not a license for appellate courts to delve into maybe issues or to order further inquiry on issues that are not properly supported.
So you want us to decide on that narrow point? I mean, that would be okay with you?
That would be fine. If that's all, I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
You may do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to begin by addressing the first issue upon which the court granted certiorari, and that is whether the filing of a civil action between two private parties, even for an improper purpose, which I'll address separately, constitutes petitioning activity protected by the First Amendment. I want to address that issue in three separate areas. The first concerns the Supremacy Clause. The second concerns the decisions of the United States Supreme Court and this court, and then the third concerns the Colorado Constitution. The Supremacy Clause provides that this Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land, and judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Similarly, federal statutes may not conflict with constitutional rights. When the United States Supreme Court speaks of constitutional rights, those rulings bind the state. And in Aaron versus Cooper, 78 of Supreme Court at 1409-1410, the Supreme Court observe that the federal judiciary is supreme in the exposition of the law of the Constitution. Part of that exposition came in the Bill Johnson's restaurant case. There, a civil suit was filed to curtail allegedly unlawful picketing activities. The defendants in that case, the picketers, alleged that the suit was a sham. In Bill Johnson's restaurant, citing the California Motor Transport case, the United States Supreme Court stated that the right of access to courts is an aspect of the First Amendment right to petition the government for redress of grievance. The filing and prosecution of a well-founded lawsuit may not be enjoined as an unfair labor practice, even if it would not have been commenced but for the plaintiff's desire to retaliate. The court went on to hold that when a suit presents genuine factual issues, the state plaintiff's First Amendment right in petitioning the state court for redress of grievances takes precedence. Thus, when a civil lawsuit presents issues of genuine material fact, the right to petition of the plaintiff cannot be trampled by either the National Labor Relations Act in the Bill Johnson case or by any state law, common law claims. Those must yield to the First Amendment right to petition. The Supreme Court noted in Bill Johnson that if the lawsuit is a baseless claim, specifically, quote, baseless litigation is not immunized by the First Amendment right to petition. And this doctrine was applied by the United States Supreme Court in Pree. That's Pree versus Columbia Pictures, which is cited by this court in its N. Ray Foster decision, noting whether to apply more in an antitrust doctrine or invoking it in other contexts. We have repeatedly reaffirmed that evidence of anti-competitive intent or purpose alone cannot transform otherwise legitimate activity into a sham. California Motor Court decision is the same, and in the Duryea case, the United States Supreme Court stated that, quote, this court's precedence confirms that the petition clause protects the right of individuals to appeal to courts and other forums established by the government for resolution of legal disputes.
So no more common law court unless the suit is completely frivolous?
Yes, unless the complaint is devoid of reasonable factual support. Otherwise,
In its entirety,
that's correct. Otherwise, Your Honor, there would be a chilling of the First Amendment right to petition the government, in this case, the court, for redress of grievances. And this court recognized in the Palm decision that the right to petition the government for redress of grievances necessarily includes access to the courts. Therefore, under the Supremacy Clause, the right of individuals to petition courts for redress of grievances in private litigation is a protected constitutional activity, and that is binding upon the states under the Supremacy Clause.
Counsel, can I stop you there? Then, how does General Steele fit within what you just said?
The holding of the General Steele decision is not wrong. It does fit within the framework of the United States Supreme Court decisions, because in General Steele, the issue involved two private parties going to a private arbitrator pursuant to their contractual agreement to have their dispute decided. That is a private dispute that does not involve bringing in any of the co-equal branches of government to resolve the dispute. Therefore, it is not petitioning activity protected under the First Amendment.
So essentially you're saying our Palm standard applies to everything that is brought before a court, every abusive process claim.
That is absolutely correct.
And the only thing General Steele stood for is that this was an arbitration case.
General Steele, that's the holding of General Steele. General Steele also noted that this court had not addressed issues such as public concern, but the holding of General Steel concern and arbitration proceeding. And that would apply, Your Honor, to all underlying civil suits, just as the court, this court in N. Ray Foster, applied the First Amendment petition clause to an underlying divorce proceeding in connection with allegations made in that underlying divorce proceeding. So if we were to try to characterize suits as being private, a divorce proceeding would be one that we might knee-jerk towards characterizing as private. But in fact, the First Amendment right to petition there applied to the individual bringing claims in the divorce proceeding and his allegations there, because this court held it was protected under the First Amendment right to petition.
But it was also an attorney regulation, right?
Well, you reach the attorney regulation matter secondary, because first you have to decide whether there's a First Amendment right to petition that's involved in the dispute. That is, whether there is a constitutional implication. Now, then the ultimate, and that involves looking at the constitutional rights that stem from the underlying civil suit, and that's what the decision addressed. Whether the First Amendment right to petition applied to that underlying civil litigation, not so much the underlying grievance procedure.
While I have you, if I may shift gears for just a moment, if there's waiver, as suggested by Mr. Maxson, then we don't even need to reach this issue, do we?
Well, there's been no waiver here, Your Honor, because the issue was clear. The issues at hand were clearly raised in the motion for summary judgment filed by HealthGrades, which directed itself to all of the underlying validity of all of HealthGrades claims. There was a motion for summary judgment filed by the other side. Both of those motions for summary judgment were denied by the court. And when we're looking at an abusive process plaintiff's claims under the Palm standard, they must make a sufficient showing to demonstrate that the petitioning activities are not immunized by the First Amendment. So we're dealing with immunity here. When that type of issue is raised, then the court must look at under an appropriate summary judgment motion to determine whether the underlying lawsuit that's the subject of the abusive process claim is devoid of reasonable factual support. And in Foster, the court said that the court looked to the Supreme Court decision in Creed, made reference to the two standards, objectively baseless and based on a subjectively improper motive. And then the court said, we expressly adopted nearly identical principles in Palm. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Pree stated that to be sham, litigation must fail to be genuine. In other words, there must not be a genuine issue of material fact under Rule 56 supporting the allegations of the complaint. And the court expressly, at page 1929 of its decision, defines genuine to state that genuine in this sense governs Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 656, under which a genuine issue is one that properly can be resolved only by a fact finder because it may reasonably be resolved in favor of either party. And describing probable cause, the court to institute a civil lawsuit, the court in Pree said that it requires, quote, no more than a reasonable belief that there is a chance a claim may be held valid for adjudication. And that's again at page 1929 of the Supreme Court's decision. And that's consistent with the Bill Johnson Supreme Court case, noting that when a suit presents genuine issues of material fact, the petitioning clause takes precedent.
Could I ask you one question about Bill Johnson? And I'm sure your opponent, with the time he's got left, will address that. But in his reply, he attempts to distinguish the Bill Johnson situation, as you recall, as one that actually simply limited the NLRB from enjoying a lawsuit rather than one that would actually protect the lawsuit under the POM standard. Would you address that?
Yes, all of these lawsuits, you know, concern whether it's the Sherman Act, whether it's the Copyright Act in Cree, whether it's a common law claim for abuse of process. All of these issues involve what is the nature of the underlying lawsuit, and does that trigger First Amendment protection? And so in the Bill Johnson restaurant case, it was determined that the private employer's lawsuit against the picketing employees triggered the petition clause and the First Amendment protection, therefore the employer filing that lawsuit. So the question, can the NLRA trump that employer's right, or can an abusive process claim trump that right? Those raise the same level of constitutional issues, because the First Amendment right to petition has been implicated, and that right cannot be lessened either by a federal statute or by a common law claim, because the First Amendment and the rights found thereunder not only are subject to the Supremacy Clause, but that also defines the marketplace of ideas that exists in this country, and it's to be a broad and robust marketplace of ideas. Hence, unless the lawsuit is devoid of reasonable factual support, as found by the trial court prior to the instruction of the jury, then the First Amendment protects.
The thrust of that answer is First Amendment is First Amendment. So if the First Amendment applies, then what we've defined as the POM standards must apply as well.
That's correct. And in this case, Your Honor, there was, getting back to our application of the test, there was a motion for summary judgment filed by HealthGrades and by Mr. Simpson and Mr. Boyer, for denied both, finding that there were genuine issues of material fact underlying HealthGrades claims. When Simpson and Boyer moved for a directed verdict during the trial of this case, the court held that, I think, this is the trial court addressing fiduciary duty of loyalty at page 58 of the May 5 transcript. I think it's an independent duty for which, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, the jury could find that the defendants have breached their fiduciary duty of loyalty. Thus, probable cause exists with respect to filing that lawsuit, and the existence of probable cause, as the court noted in Creed, is an absolute defense. Thus, since there's a reasonable chance that the lawsuit may be established by virtue of these summary judgment rulings, the case should be remanded for further analysis by the trial court under the qualitative merit standard that was adopted by the Court of Appeals in its decision.
Counsel, can you just stop there for a moment and address, I guess, your opposing counsel's argument that the Court of Appeals went way beyond the questions presented?
Well,
How does that affect it? So is it difficult to put you in that position? Well, because you won, but I guess I'm wondering, what do you do with that?
Well, I don't believe they did at all, Your Honor, because the requested relief that was sought was apply the POM standard. The trial court found that there were genuine issues of material fact. Therefore, on that basis, the lawsuit was not a sham, and judgment should have been entered in favor of HealthGrades in connection with the abuse of process claim. What the Court of Appeals did was that they adopted a qualitative merit standard. So they said, in essence, HealthGrades, we understand the position you're taking regarding this summary judgment ruling, but we really think the trial court should have said that. They only provided a sentence saying there are genuine issues of material fact. And with respect to the directed verdict motion, we don't think the trial court said enough, despite what I quoted regarding the breach of duty of loyalty. We don't think the trial court said enough there. Therefore, we're going to remand the case to the trial court to address from a qualitative merits review and determine under the appropriate summary judgment standard, that is looking at the evidence regarding HealthGrades lawsuit and determining whether the litigation was a sham, and write a little bit more about it. And And in cases in which an appellate court announces a new standard, this qualitative merit standard is a new standard, it's proper to remand the case, and it's typical to remand the case to the trial court to apply the standard in the first instance.
Can I interrupt you with that? Because I'm really wanting to understand your view of the mechanics of how you think this framework ought to work. Do you disagree with the Court of Appeals reasoning that the POM standard ought to be something that's addressed strictly by the trial court and not something that goes to the jury?
No, it should be decided by the trial court.
Yes. Okay, so this shouldn't go to, this issue should never go to the jury.
It should go to the jury only after the POM standard has been applied. If there are issues that remain.
Well, so let's take an example. All right, hypothetical lawsuit is filed. A counterclaim for abusive process is filed. The defense is raised. The POM defense is raised either through a 12B or a Rule 56 motion. And you're saying the trial court should address that whether the POM standard, whether the party alleging the abusive process has met the POM standard.
Correct. That's
okay.
Correct.
So walk me through what happens if it's met and if it's not.
Okay. So this is an issue regarding immunity and First Amendment immunity regarding the right to petition. So if the trial court reviews the evidence and determines that viewing the evidence in the light favorable to the party who brought the underlying lawsuit, if those claims are not devoid of reasonable factual support, then judgment should be entered in favor of the party bringing the lawsuit, and the abusive process claim should be dismissed.
Okay.
If the court finds that there are genuine issues of material fact, then the issue could theoretically either be ruled on by the trial court or submitted to the jury to resolve it under the POM standard.
So, well, that's the piece that I want some clarification on from you. Are you saying then that the jury decides the POM, whether the POM standard has been met, or simply whether if the party bringing the abusive process claim has met the POM standard and the abusive process claim now can proceed to the jury, all the jury is really deciding is now whether the elements of the abusive process claim have been met?
Yes, but the court performs its gatekeeper function at the outset. And that's the essence.
I don't disagree. I'm just trying to figure out what is the jury actually deciding in that process at the end. In other words, if the POM elements have in fact been met, trial court says, you know what, the party bringing the abusive process has met the POM standard. It's baseless, there's no devoid, it's devoid of any legal basis, etc. What happens then?
Then the case would be submitted to the jury.
On the abusive process?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And that, Your Honor, involves the court performing its gatekeeper function at the outset, applying the POM standard, which did not happen here. As the Court of Appeals noted, that standard was not applied by the trial court, and this court made it clear in POM that the plaintiff must make a sufficient showing to permit the court to reasonably conclude that the defendant's petitioning activities were not immunized. And then this court, addressing in the IREA case, in the defamation context, said that IREA must make a sufficient showing to permit the district court to reasonably conclude that the petitioning activities were not constitutionally immunized. In the general Steele case, the court noted that it did not endorse the procedure followed by the trial court, which submitted the POM instructions to the jury, but without the gatekeeping function necessary to be performed by the court. And the question of probable cause under the sham litigation use of process tort is to be decided by the judge, as referenced in the New Mexico case, issues and interpretations of law such as immunity or traditionally functions of the trial court to protect constitutional and other rights and should be applied as a safeguard to the First Amendment. And here I think it's important to note that private suits between litigants further societal interests. Our entire common law structure was founded on such suits. And the development of the common law of Colorado is every bit as important as a citizen lobbying an elected representative. Lawsuits, even from the most innocuous acts, like the divorce proceeding involving Mr. Foster, create new laws regarding how society should be organized and refine the doctrines of stare decisis. When we look back at cases like Paul's Graph versus Long Island Railway, a scale fell in the railway station. McPherson versus Buick, there was a car accident. From those humble beginnings come the doctrines of foreseeability and the doctrines of products liability. Each case that's filed in court is important to the citizens involved in that case. And that makes the cases of societal significance because the court has an obligation to make certain that...
Well, we also know that lawsuits can, arguably at times, are brought just feet down the other side, cost them expense and delay, disrupt their lives, and ruin their chances of actually getting justice. So... would you take a look a little bit, counsel, at the other side here of this?
Yes, Your Honor, there's no question about that. And then, but the issue is, what should the standard be, and how far will there be encroachment upon the First Amendment right? The devoid of reasonable factual support standard provides that protection for the First Amendment, and also allows citizens to be free from a process that is abused in the context of...
Well, I'm trying to talk to the loading up of all kinds of causes of action, 9 that are sham, 1 that arguably has some merit.
Well, Your Honor, that raises the issue of sort of whether the standard should be applied to the entire lawsuit, or whether it should be applied to certain claims brought within a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And I think the first issue here is what was pled in this case. And here, if we look at the plaintiff's amended counterclaim at paragraphs 17, they pled that the plaintiff's claims lack reasonable factual basis and cognizable basis in law and are sham. The complaint filed by plaintiff was a sham in paragraph 9. And the order granting the leave to amend specifically found, this is the January 7, 2011 order, defendants alleged that Health Grades engaged in abusive process by seeking to obtain money from defendants without a valid claim regarding the improper purpose element, and then the court goes on to address the two elements of pre. Thus, at its most basic level, this case involved a pleading that involves allegations that the entire litigation is a sham. But if we look at the issue and assume that that's not the case, and try to determine, well, should sham litigation apply to the entire claim, or should it apply to only some claims? The entire tort, as recognized by the United States Supreme Court, which is where this doctrine started, refers to sham litigation. Thus, the issue involves litigation involving the entire lawsuit. As this court referenced in Foster, the sham litigation claim must make a sufficient showing to permit the court to reasonably conclude that defendant's underlying lawsuit was not protected by the First Amendment. And focusing on the underlying lawsuit is the correct standard. And one of the reasons is that torts like abusive process and malicious prosecution are disfavored because of the potential chilling effect they have on the First Amendment right of access to the courts. That's something that's recognized in New Mexico and Fleetwood by this court in Hewitt versus Wright. Thus, the determination of this issue should cause the least chilling effect on a litigant's access to the courts.
Statutes and common law claims that encroach on First Amendment rights must be curtailed to fit within constitutional rights. Clients are entitled to zealous advocacy that should not be clouded with an impermissible chilling effect. And focusing on each claim would invite a multitude of unwarranted litigations. That's from the court, the Mexico Supreme Court in Fleetwood. And at the conclusion of each case, where a plaintiff prevailed on some of his claims, but not all of these claims, the defendant would sift through the evidence and try to find a way to offset the ledger by claiming that a particular claim that the plaintiff did not prevail upon was somehow devoid of factual support. And that type of 20/20 hindsight and flaw-specking of the evidence is not something that brings forth a societal good. If, from the common nucleus of operative facts, there has been stated a proper claim for relief, then the entire complaint with respect to those operative facts should preclude a sham litigation abuse of process claim. To hold otherwise would hamper proper advocacy and the assertion of claims for which there is a reasonable argument that the law should be extended. So we have in place in Colorado Rule 11, and we also have in place in Colorado CRS 1317-102, which are sufficient deterrents to preclude the filing of frivolous claims.
What wasn't this submitted to the jury, though, on whether the whole lawsuit was a sham? I mean, the record reveals that there was discussion about that by the trial judge.
Yes.
And instruction number 31 doesn't delineate the specific claims to which Mr. Maxson referred in the counterclaim. It just talks about the claims, the lawsuit. So the
right.
Jury arguably made the decision on the entirety of the lawsuit being a sham.
That's correct. But the issue, Your Honor, is whether the trial court performed its gatekeeping function under POM by looking at the evidence to determine whether or not the underlying lawsuit was not immunized by the First Amendment and applying the POM standard to that analysis. Thus, when the court says in the case of the breach of fiduciary duty, that the jury could find the defendants have breached the duty of loyalty, that is indicative that the court did not apply the POM standard. Regarding the arguments at page 65 in connection with the motion for a directed verdict, there's reference there to the other side's argument. There's a disputed factual issue whether or not there was actual competition. We believe the jury could reasonably find that Inaudible had no impact on plaintiff's revenue. When you're talking about what the jury could reasonably find, that involves whether a claim is devoid of reasonable factual support. And so to the extent that there's an acknowledgement that there's evidence to support HealthGrad's claims, that is indicative that the lawsuit itself is not objectively baseless. And when the court ruled on the motion for JNOB, the court expressly stated that reasonable minds could differ. Well, if reasonable minds can differ regarding the underlying allegations made by HealthGrad, then it follows that the claims are not devoid of reasonable factual support because reasonable minds could differ. And if the claims are not devoid, then it's part of the First Amendment protection under the petitioning clause that the claims should not go to the jury because they are immunized under POM. And here, looking at the record as the Court of Appeals did, the trial court did not apply the POM standard as it should have, and this issue was raised by HealthGrades in its Rule 56 motion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We have a little time left on the ball. Looks like about 3 minutes.
The Supreme Court has never held that the First Amendment right to petition clause mandates the home sham litigation standard. In fact, its decision in Dorita versus Guarnieri specifically rejected the sham litigation standard that was used by the Third Circuit. There's never been a holding from the U.S. Supreme Court that that is the required constitutional standard. I invite the court to look at page 747 of the Bill Johnson's decision, where the Supreme Court specifically says that a private lawsuit brought for improper purposes after that suit is unsuccessfully concluded can, consistent with the petition clause, give rise to liability. Additionally, as we stated in our briefs, the Michigan Supreme Court has applied an intermediate standard to petitions involving private persons and matters of private concern. There, I don't believe that there is a single case holding that the petition clause always requires its constitutional protection. The cases such as professional real estate investment that respondent relies on, I'm sorry, professional real estate investments are antitrust cases decided in the antitrust context. Numerous courts throughout the country have refused to extend the PRE sham litigation standard in other contexts. The district of the D.C. Circuit in Petrochem Insulation versus NLRB 240 F3rd 26 recognized that the Supreme Court has several standards for sham litigation and that it's higher in the antitrust context than in other contexts. In the Ninth Circuit in Diamond Walnut Growers versus NLRB 53 F3rd 1085 refused to extend the PRE sham litigation standard when an employer filed a retaliatory lawsuit. The Federal Claims Court in 93 in Morse versus Secretary of Health and Human Services 93 Fed.CL 780 declined to extend the PRE baseless lawsuit standard in the vaccine case. There are numerous other decisions saying that the PRE standard is specific only to the antitrust context. Regarding waiver, there was no argument on appeal that all the evidence submitted at trial demonstrated that the claims had any reasonable factual basis. That argument was not made on appeal. The Court of Appeals specifically recognized that the briefs addressed it and remanded for consideration of that issue anyway. That is improper sua sponte review. Finally, on the issue of societal benefit, there is no societal benefit to suits such as this. We are on year 5 of a lawsuit that has caused financial ruin for petitioners, in which the respondent admitted at trial that it had not suffered any monetary harm as a result of their activities. There is no valid purpose articulated for this suit, and there was no harm to respondents. There is no benefit to pursuing such suits. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Maxson, and you, Mr. Kolodansky, for your arguments today. Let's see, I think we're in recess now until tomorrow at 9 o'clock.